Hi, I'm Ron Coleman, a partner in the Dillon Law Group, social media legend and free speech enthusiast. When I started the Coleman Nation podcast in the spring of 2021, its focus was on free expression and censorship on the internet. But as important as that subject is to me, which is very important, I felt hemmed in the podcast. I wanted to spend more time talking to the interesting people I've met in my legal and free speech work without feeling a need to have them all make the same point. So I culminated the first series of the podcast and have started the second series. I hope you'll enjoy these conversations as much as I have recording them. Hello, Culminators. Welcome back. You know, it's been about a year. Not quite. Maybe by the time you see this, it probably will be, though, since I welcomed Mike Mathis to the program, where we talked about the IBI. That is the Institute for a Better Internet. It is a nonpartisan, balanced group of people, which means two-thirds of the people hate whatever they have to say on any given topic, that is trying to deal with really what is one of the most important issues of our time, whether you acknowledge it or not. How do I know? Because I say so. And so does Mike, and so do a lot of other people with big pointy heads like ours, which is internet censorship in this broadest possible sense. So Mike and I thought it would be a good time to catch up because there's a lot going on. We had the argument in Biden. I keep wanting to call it Biden versus Missouri. That'll pass. Especially when the opinion comes out, I'll certainly want to hear what Mike thinks it's how it's going to look when it comes out. But things are definitely going on. Mike, how's it going?
Very good. Appreciate you having me back. We've actually evolved our thinking and our proposed solution a fair amount since a year ago. And we can talk about that. In a lot of ways, we moved to simplify a proposal in terms of a proposed solution in order to avoid the political difficulty of getting really a more complex solution through our political system, which is, as you know, very divided. And it's been very interesting to see some of these issues are now being debated and, as you said, you know, partly determined, you know, through our court system, particularly with this Missouri versus Murphy, but also with the previous one, the Texas and Florida laws that were debated a few weeks ago, where those states put their own laws forward to try to enforce some viewpoint neutrality, you know, related to political speech emanating from their states.
Now, what you guys, if I remember correctly, were talking about was let's try to establish some dispute resolution system.
Exactly. And that proved to be very challenging. So we developed a non-government, a proposal for a non-government entity modeled after something called FINRA, which I think we talked about last year. FINRA is a really cool example because it exists. It operates at very large scale, and it adjudicates disputes between investors and the finance industry. FINRA stands for Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. And we thought it was an excellent model. And I've been discussing that with a number of folks on Capitol Hill and in Washington. And there's a lot of nodding of agreement, but particularly from Republican side, and a lot of concern on the other side, the Democrat side, that you know, they didn't really see the need for it. And but the key element was to have it be a non-government entity. So whoever is in charge in the future would not be able to politically, you know, determine content moderation policies while their, you know, administration is there. So we've kind of backed off that a bit. And what we moved to is a transparency focus, meaning not just making the rules of YouTube transparent and visible to users, but a whole bunch of other aspects of their content moderation which today are opaque. So for example, they do, they have their rules, but if you are experiencing some sort of enforcement action, you really have no idea what you did wrong, which content that you posted violated what rule. But more importantly, they do have some regular reporting, kind of on a monthly or quarterly basis, that says, we discovered this many million pieces, posts of content of, you know, child pornography, or this many million pieces of promoting violence, or whatever it might be. But it's very broad categories. And some of the categories are also government request. That's literally what it says, government request to do something with our content, you know, to remove a post or label it or whatever that might be.
When you say what it says, you mean this under your proposal?
No, this is today.
This is what exists now, is that there is this kind of reporting is being.
Yes, by the larger platforms. But what they're reporting is very broad and very generalized, and it looks like a spreadsheet. And it's just kind of showing, hey, we're actively moderating content, and it's a little bit of a pat on the back that they're doing these things. But what's important is, if you're really trying to use transparency as a tool to ensure both online safety and viewpoint neutrality, and a third category, which has come up with Murthy, is to make transparent any communications coming from the government to you in terms of content moderation. These transparency reports could be very helpful and very powerful if they were made more detailed. For example, when there are content moderation decisions, they should highlight which content categories were these in. Was this related to COVID? Was this related to Hamas? Was this related to Ukraine? Was this related to election integrity, or whatever it might be? So today you don't really know which content categories are being heavily moderated. And then you don't know, well, what types of enforcement actions happened. And, you know, outside of protecting privacy of individual users, exactly.
This is the website which gives you the takeaways.
Yes, this is what they have today, exactly.
And as you observed, this is, if you want the raw data, this is that spreadsheet.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot there that's very useful.
Because it tends to be conclusory, as we say it.
Yeah.
Dangerous orgs. What's a dangerous org? Oh, ones that we consider dangerous.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, firearms, regulated goods. What about firearms? Firearms.
Right. And, you know, then you find out things like, you may recall a while ago when I think it was Media Matters was reporting there was a lot of anti-Semitic content, you know, on X or Twitter. And it turned out some of it was content where people complained about George Soros. And it's sort of implied, well, if you complain about George Soros, you're anti-Semitic. I mean, so they had kind of unfair categorizations of, you know, what was bad content or, you know, harmful content. So this report could be, so this demonstrates that they can easily make these reports. It's very workable for them, but they need to add much more detail so we can get a sense, well, who's being moderated and what kind of moderation? Did you ban this person? Did you block this particular content? Did you, you know, do what they call de-emphasize or de-promote, which nobody really knows when that happens because they don't come out and tell you, hey,
well, you know,
we're de-promoting you. It's like, it just sort of happens. And you wonder why you don't get as much reaction, you know, to your content.
Yeah.
So when they do that and they let the reporting is, well, it's in these content categories, that would allow media and the public to be able to compare these different platforms, see how they perform in general on content moderation and biases. Are they focused on online safety? Is there viewpoint neutrality problems? And then you can compare them with their peers and you might discover a difference between X, YouTube, Instagram, you know, other things like that. So that's basically what our proposal. And then we went away from this, created an entity, just because asking Congress to create an entity was very difficult. You know, part of the government wants to create new agencies. They want the government to do it. And then another part didn't really trust the idea of creating anything, any sort of entity. So it turned out what was more acceptable is just simply to rely on the existing court system to resolve issues. And so you would have a mandate to mandate transparency across all this stuff, including transparency of government communications. You know, because the big problem that we see with Murthy is, well, what communications are acceptable? The government, you know, is allowed to speak. And what kinds of communications are constitutionally not acceptable? You know, if the government is telling Twitter or Facebook, hey, you need to ban this user because it's malinformation, which is a new word we learned in the past year, right? We know misinformation, disinformation. Now we have malinformation, which it turns out malinformation is true, but inconvenient. And then that word was actually used by the sort of censorship industrial complex, you know, one of the people involved in that from Stanford. So now you just, you know, if that becomes transparent,
I don't want to skip over that the censorship industrial complex, that's a phrase that you just used.
Yeah.
And we should take note of it, because it's a real thing. And there was just a tweet yesterday in the last day or so, one of the, you know, one of the members of this cabal that you just referred to.
Yeah.
Complaining about just that, about how, there's been all this reduction in,
and I think part money. Of it is the glare of publicity. And I'm not sure. I do remember Alex Stamos, and then there's a woman, Renee DiResta, who were at this thing at Stanford, or sponsored by Stanford, called the Election Integrity Project, EIP, which then changed its name to Virality. But yeah, they were complaining because of all the legal costs that Stanford was bearing on their behalf. And of course, Stanford eventually said, you know, why are we involved in this stuff? Do we want to be involved in this controversial content moderation stuff? But the censorship industrial complex, which is a word, I think Michael Schellenberger used that word first in testimony in Congress, but there is a government agency called CISA, and the acronym sort of escapes me, but it is part of the Department of Homeland Security. And they literally funded and created this cabal of Stanford Internet Observatory, something called Graphica, the Atlantic Council, and the University of Washington. Yeah, Kate Starbird is part of this.
And of course, you know, the presumptive correctness of government and government / academic, you can call whatever, like you said, as the phrase implies, it's a complex. It's not just the government. It's a bunch of elite institutions that are going to decide gatekeeping.
Yeah.
So 60 Minutes, CBS, wants as much gatekeeping as possible, because A, they're in the gatekeeping business themselves, and B, competitors such as social media that don't do enough gatekeeping for their taste are a competition with 60 Minutes.
Yeah, that's right. And it turns out, you know, the model of 60 Minutes and New York Times and Fox News, they're publishers. So they're free to publish and write whatever bias, whatever opinion, whatever they want to do. And it's kind of understood. You know, the challenge with a monopoly platform, which is what Facebook is, when you include Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, that's all part of, you know, Meta, or YouTube, which is the video sharing site, is they are, you know, by many surveys, like Pew surveys, that is where people go. to get information and to learn about current events and newsworthy topics, and in particular, you know, political decisions. Yeah, and so now you have these companies that say, well, all we're doing is sharing user content, and they have something which there's a law called Section 230 that protects them from any liability, because they say, look, we're not making editorial decisions here. We're just sharing user content, with the exception of illegal content. And, you know, but the problem, the challenge is they get into all this sort of, well, we don't like that content, so we're going to
start. No, I mean, the community guidelines on YouTube and Facebook are they're a punchline.
Yeah.
Everyone knows that they are entirely editorial decisions. And for a decade plus now, judges have simply absolutely punted on this. They have just resolutely refused to see what everyone else, what is obvious to everyone who and anyone who says otherwise is merely either in denial or, you know, gaslighting.
Yeah.
So you're saying, okay, I don't know how we can ever resolve these issues. I don't know if we can resolve how much the government can influence, can speak, can suggest. But while we figure that out, or even if we never figure that out, let's at least shine light on the entire process.
Exactly. Exactly.
Which would be a gigantic step forward.
Yeah.
But you might say, let's just vote for the candidates we like, and then we'll know who people really want to elect. And what we find out is that as long as people are in charge of counting votes, we're not necessarily really voting. And one of the things that's come up in the last couple of months, well, not last couple of months, but it's really getting more and more attention, is in order to reduce reporting of minority crime,
mm-hmm.
urban police departments are at a rate that seems to exceed what would be a predictable error rate, reporting crime by minority members as crimes by white people.
Yeah, I just saw an example of that today where there was illegal immigrant came over and committed a heinous crime, and they showed, you know, his mugshot, and the mugshot showed he was a white person.
Right. I should have had that one ready, but I guess it only occurred to me, okay, this is interesting. Someone, I don't know if this statistic is actually true, but during Clinton, according to this Art Nickel, they redesignated Hispanics as white, the FBI, I guess.
Yeah.
I think more transparency would be better, because as you observed in the Stanford case, simply putting attention on the fact that this is happening is a big plus. But there still has to be some auditability. I mean, one of my concerns has always been, and I don't know why no one has, maybe people have brought this lawsuit and it has failed, but if you're advertising on, I mean, there was some allusion to this a couple of years ago, and probably after the Democrats got, and I want to point out, Mike is not a conservative, as far as I know. He's certainly not an activist conservative. He really is a nonpartisan. So if anything I say that sounds partisan, do not ascribe to Mike if he just answers the question without a gigantic disclaimer. Okay. Yeah. We're just having a conversation. Here's Mike talking to a conservative. Okay. There was a lot of talk about the fact that if you can't trust, if there's suppression going on, as you pointed out, that's one of the ways that you can censor someone, is to, you know, just not permit their message to be to reach people.
Mm-hmm.
That would seem like some kind of problem in the area of charging people either to use the platform you know, for a premium membership or of some kind, or to advertise on the platform, especially if you're going to report data, and in the case of Facebook and Google, these are public companies, so there are other implications as well. You're going to report data about users and about engagement or whatever the data, you know, whatever the metrics might be. If you're preventing certain users from getting messages they otherwise would get based on.
Right. You're diminishing the service.
I don't know. I mean, I know that when I was, you know, in radio, they have. There's a sort of auditing function, you know, for if you do radio advertising, if you're the broadcaster and you take money for radio advertising, you have to provide the advertiser who paid you the money with certain kinds of data about when the ads were run, and you know, sort of an audit trail to make sure that he got what he paid for. And that, I don't think that would be an interesting thing for you to look at if you haven't already.
For sure. I 100% agree that that's a challenge. One of the things that came from one of the senior leaders in the Senate Judiciary Committee was said, Mike, you really have to protect whistleblowers. So when there's a whistleblower inside one of these companies, and they're big companies and lots of pressure, but you need to make sure the same way we protect a whistleblower in a government agency, we need, the law would have to protect the whistleblower so they can't be fired or financially punished if they come forward, you know, with, you know, information. You may recall a few years ago, there was a woman named Frances Haugen who came forward from Meta and wasn't talking about censorship, was actually talking about there's not enough censorship and wanted more. But she was kind of more focused on the problem of echo chambers and how the algorithms keep steering, especially young people, to the same unhealthy content that leads to you know, self-harm and things like that. So we need to protect the whistleblowers. And as you pointed out, if there is a challenge that says, hey, somebody has some reason to believe that you are not transparent as you're mandated to be, there could be a case with discovery that says you have to prove, you know, there's a discovery process there. And they're very sensitive as publicly traded companies, as you said, to their customers, because it's a data business. If the advertisers think Facebook is lying about how many people view their ad, that would be a big deal for Zuckerberg.
And you would also think that stockholders, and of course, in the case of Facebook, that's a very, that doesn't mean what it usually does, because Zuckerberg.
But I think I think, Ron, this would be really powerful to force this transparency, because it reminds me of somebody made a comment to me about the guy, Murdoch, I forget the guy who started Fox News. But anyway, he said, you know, they
Roger
had this,
Ailes? Roger Ailes?
Yes, Roger Ailes said, well, we just have this idea. We're going to go after this little niche market, you know, because at that time it was just, you know, three big television networks and CNN. And maybe, I don't remember if MSNBC was already there, but we're generally after this little niche market that happens to be 50% of the country. So, you know, isn't ultra liberal or whatever. So I think, you know, I think executives at Google, Meta, Twitter, Snap, all these companies kind of know that, you know, 50% of their users are not necessarily this, you know, very far left, you know, group that's so influential in the sort of elite media that you mentioned, CBS, 60 Minutes, you know, New York Times, that kind of thing.
Well, there's also been, you know, there's a famous saying, and again, as I do so often to my fellow culminators, apologizing for, you may have heard this one before, a little bit of light dispels a great deal of darkness.
Yeah.
Musk's purchase of Twitter has put more pressure, in my view, on, even though Google, as I just showed in a tweet dated today, March 25th, when we're recording this, apparently is going to clamp down even more on their community standards. YouTube is on an insane self-destructive downward cycle. And I there's a real level of irrationality there. I mean, the company itself has major, major business problems.
Mm-hmm.
And it's far beyond the scope of this discussion. But by virtue of opening up one of the major social media platforms to relatively balanced discourse, Musk has put pressure, in my opinion, on the other ones, because the attempt, which was never realistic, but it doesn't mean they won't try it, but the attempt to monopolize all forms of communication,
mm-hmm.
so that we could go back to the three networks,
yeah,
and you know, three newspapers and the Associated Press model, just
right.
a larger number. That can never work in this modern technological era, but it was a gigantic step forward for him. You know, I hope it does. I hope it's economically going to last on to some level. But
yeah, I think it's very interesting, because another thing that's going on that's huge news in Washington right now is the idea of banning TikTok. Or forcing ByteDance, which is a Chinese company that owns TikTok, to sell it. And some people on the right, I read, say they're really worried about that would create a precedent that says, oh, this is a Trojan horse to come after X, and to, you know, come after Elon Musk, because the way the law is written, it's if you're controlled by a foreign adversary, or if you have foreign ownership, then you could be subject to the government banning you or forcing you to be, you know, to be sold. But it's a very interesting topic, because it's also tangentially comes into the whole free speech, you know, debate. And I mean, personally, I'm not real happy about the Chinese Communist Party having, you know, such indirect influence over what the content might be on TikTok, which if you have, you know, children, or you know people with children, you know, they are all on TikTok all the time. It's incredibly addictive. And
I have four adult children.
Yeah.
None of whom had smartphones growing up, and only two of whom have smartphones even now. None of them is involved in TikTok. People make decisions, but let's face it, we live in a society, okay?
Yeah.
So not everyone can raise the kids the way the Colemans do.
Yeah. But it's interesting, because China has, you know, mostly banned Google and Facebook and things. So, you know, you can kind of, but around the world, most of the world puts up with Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, because that's what it is. So there's a lot of interesting challenges here, I think, around the idea of banning TikTok.
The thing about TikTok is, to say that we're not trying to shut it down, we're just saying it can't be owned by foreign governments.
Right.
Because who better than the United States government to tell us when foreign governments are interfering with something?
Yeah.
Like that time Russia
exactly.
controlled the 2016 election. And all those Russian spies. Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
At the end of the day, Mike, it still comes down to integrity and trust. And I suppose that's why more transparency is better, because at least when there is more transparency, if data is being hidden or mischaracterized, what we saw during the beginning of the Twitter files moment, mm-hmm. was
yeah.
that, and if also during the Trump-Russia stuff, resourceful people break out their own spreadsheets and they start lining up data, and they come back and say, this doesn't add up. This timeline doesn't work. This email doesn't fit with what this person said. The more transparency you have,
yeah,
the more opportunity there is for people to do that kind of thing.
Exactly.
So you began this sort of turnaround 6 months ago, would you say?
Yeah, I kept running into the same resistance, which was two. One is, how do you define the rules, even the vocabulary, but how do you define the guardrails of online safety and viewpoint neutrality? And I mean, when you talk to one side or the other, you just get completely different vocabulary and ideas. You know, Democrats will say there is no censorship going on of conservative viewpoints. Don't believe you. Not happening. And then you have the you know, they're more focused on CSAM, which is child pornography or child sexual abuse material. There was a really interesting hearing that I was at a couple months ago there. And then the other side, the Republican, is much more focused on, hey, you're censoring me, you're censoring my sort of conservative colleagues, my conservative media, content, whatever it is. So there's just a fundamental disagreement. And then you sometimes literally hear people say, well, gosh, it sounds like you're saying my own voice is literally online violence. It's just so harmful for someone to hear that.
Stochastic terrorism.
Yes, exactly. And then it's amazing to me that young people are still even as balanced as they are because of this idea of microaggressions and this bias going on university campuses is just beyond belief.
It's a gigantic failure. It's a gigantic failure of our generation to properly teach civics and, yeah, you know, and fundamental concepts of how we listen to others and how we make moral decisions. And when we decide some ideas are outside the pale,
right,
and there are lots of reasons why that might have taken place, but we've seen, and certainly since October 7th of last year, we've really seen it, phenomenal instances of moral inversion that spring from this hijacking of language and meaning.
Yeah.
So all of which is just to say, I know what you're saying. You can't even have the conversation about what should the conversation be anymore.
Right. Right.
So what kind of feedback have you gotten then on the let's switch to transparency approach?
So far, you know, it feels much more doable. Objections that people had, you know, we basically have dealt with the objections by getting rid of the complexity of how, you know, in my mind, I could see the ongoing operation of this FINRA entity that would deal with disputes and it would adjudicate disputes, but it was very hard to figure out how you set the darn thing up in the beginning. Who's going to set this up? You know, who do we pick? Ron, do you want to set it up? Mike, you know, should we have Chuck Schumer set it up? Anyway, who's going to set this up? So anyway, when I kind of came around to, well, transparency was the one thing pretty much everyone agreed on. Everyone likes transparency. So that was the path. And then the more I thought about transparency, and I thought, you know, if you really do transparency right, you will accomplish the goals of making online safety and viewpoint neutrality both kind of visible to people to be able to measure and compare.
Why? What's the, I don't necessarily know if I would mean constitutional, but what's the conceptual distinction in the year 2024 between requiring transparency online compared to requiring it with traditional media, which is largely online anyway?
Right.
I mean, I suppose social media is different because they're relying on Section 230 to say we're not really in the editorial business. Okay, fine. I get that. That maybe answers my question.
A lot of industries are very heavily regulated, and they tend to be industries that are concentrated with a very small number of monopoly or near monopoly players. So you think of telecom, utilities, but even all sorts of transportation, you know, they have to report a lot of data. So it's perfectly reasonable to ask an industry to report a lot of data on their performance. And in this case, the performance that we're talking about has to do with content moderation performance. And everyone, the whole industry, we're not picking on one company. We're saying the whole industry, or at least above a certain, you know, scale, above a certain threshold of size, needs to do this reporting on a quarterly basis. And it's not unusually onerous compared to the reporting they're doing today.
Well, not only the reporting they're doing today, but the data they're generating and selling.
Oh, yeah.
Already. Yeah. They already know all this. It's simply a matter of how much they want to disclose. This is the business model. The business model is this. Okay, it's not the moderation per se, except to some extent it is, because some of their investors demand to know, are you doing the right thing by keeping everybody safe? Information is all there.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that's why, and I think you know a lot more for sure on this topic than most people, but this whole information censorship and all that around Hamas and this war in Gaza really has thrown a lot of people for a loop and confused a lot of traditional people, because suddenly they were like, oh, wait a minute. You know, we're now saying this information is should be censored. And for example, whether you're pro-Israel or pro-Hamas, and a lot of people came out of the woodwork and kind of shocked. It's like, oh my God, there's a lot of anti-Semitic leftists here. The Democratic Party has a fair number of anti-Semitic members and supporters. But you know, the other thing that's happened a lot in the last year is the EU has introduced some regulations, and a lot of people that I talk to, because you're right, I think of myself as nonpartisan and in the middle, but I also recognize I'm a bit, I like a red berry floating in the blue sea of Northern California, you know, where I live, which is kind of part of how this whole thing got kicked off. But in the EU, there's this interesting guy named Thierry Breton, who I don't know if you've ever interviewed him or
no.
He calls himself the digital commissar of the EU. That's his on X of what he, and he's a digital enforcer is what he said on some interview. But you know, the EU has created something called the Digital Services Act, DSA, and it's designed to do kind of what we're talking about, not transparency, but literally the government of each country is allowed to set up something they call it a coordinator. And then each digital services coordinator, you got 27 countries, so you got 27 of these coordinators who are agencies. They get to designate what they call trusted flaggers that will flag content. And one of the first things they did was they sent letters to Meta, Google, X, Snap, I think, and TikTok, saying you have 24 hours to explain why your content moderation is so inaccurate with regard to, you know, what's going on after October 7th. I mean, it was just nuts. And it's what happens when you don't have transparency and you just have government people kind of running amok who have bureaucratic power demanding content moderation.
Let me ask you because I'm thinking about what you're describing about this influx of, I mean, if there's truly a meaning to the word disinformation, the stuff we have seen coming in on the Israel conflict has been phenomenal.
Yeah.
And we always say, and our principle is always more information is better. More information, you know, good information rounds out bad information. But what happens when you have millions and millions of people who are absolutely dedicated? This is theoretical, because I don't know for a fact that this is the case at all, but millions and millions of people who are absolutely dedicated to promulgating false information. And I don't mean opinions. I mean, the Israeli government committed October 7th and 9/11, like crazy stuff. Jews have horns, whatever.
I just saw today an example where they said some Western news organization said IDF soldiers were raping people in Gaza hospitals or something. And then they came out and said, it was Al Jazeera said it was false. It wasn't true. But still, you know, the point of the article was that first false headline is what everyone remembers.
My question is, notwithstanding these specific things, I mean, what you're saying is true, but what I'm saying is, so part of your answer is, Ron, before you even come onto the question of quantity, if you simply say something that is attractive enough to the opinion maker, to the influencers, whether they are traditional media outlets or governments or the United Nations, et cetera, or a political party or political figure, nothing like that recency effect will immediately profoundly affect the way people see things. But I'm also saying that, isn't it the case that sometimes bad information sticks around for forever?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it is not a response, in my opinion, to say, so therefore let's have the government solve that, because the government has not in any way demonstrated that it can be trusted to do that.
Right. Well, you're pointing out an interesting area, which we're just starting to work on, I think, if I understand your question, which is kind of how does, because you mentioned thousands of dedicated people, but how does a wave of propaganda go viral across Facebook or go viral across YouTube or whatever? And there was an interesting company called CrowdTangle, which was acquired by Meta a few years ago. And it was originally designed to help advertisers, to your point earlier, to know what's going on. But it turned out it made visible, you know, how some users were able to create these
viral phenomena. Yeah.
Viral phenomena where no matter who you are, when you go on, all you see is content about some point of view or some content. And so we're starting to go learn about it, talk to some of those people. You know, we do spend a lot of time talking to these companies, but what you're talking about is also very interesting. And there might be a transparency solution that says, if there's a way to identify these viral things, which this CrowdTangle company did, that we should make that transparent so we can see when propaganda waves, whether it's anti-Semitic or anti-conservative or anti-gun or pro-gun or, you know, whatever it is, southern border stuff, that we can kind of see what's going on, and are those authentic viral trends or are they inauthentic because it's bots and spam and crazy stuff like that?
AI.
This is a whole nother crazy topic. Yeah.
Yeah. Because you mentioned, Next bought it. Well, really, is that, you know, because Google has a tendency of buying things and then killing them.
Yeah.
And here they so profoundly show their hand.
Oh, totally. Very much so. I agree with you. Yeah. There's a lot of articles talking that are from former employees, and it's hard to tell, you know, if they're disgruntled or what, but, you know, coming out talking about how DEI and woke has really infected the core of Google. And this output is exactly what you would expect, that they just completely screwed the pooch, so to speak, and made a product that is unusable.
So what do you think your Institute for a Better Internet, what does it look like for 2024? Are you getting more meetings? You're getting more people paying attention, or what's?
Yeah, I think so. We don't have a donate button on our site, so we're not just trying to get clicks and views.
That's right. You know,
mostly what I do is I go to Washington about every 3 months and have a series of discussions, and try to move the ball forward and understand what has to change to make some real impact, you know? Because there's lots of people writing about how horrible censorship is and how examples of egregious things that have happened. So we're more trying to focus on a solution. And, you know, it's an election year, as you know, so I think it's hard to do anything in an election year. it's kind of weird how our government is set up. You know, basically, there seems to be about 12 months opportunity after an election to do anything. And then after that, forget it. It's just, you're on to it.
We've also, I mean, we're seeing a level of dysfunction that you and I in our lifetimes have never seen. I mean,
yeah, it's depressing. And I, you know, and it's also,
wait a minute, though.
People's politics, but then,
riddle me this. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
yeah.
I haven't had a good explanation for this. I mean, I know one answer is the Jews, but I haven't heard a non-insane explanation for, given the dysfunction and the utter politicization, how is there all of a sudden, in the course of a couple of weeks, this consensus on Capitol Hill on the TikTok bill? Where did that come from? What drove that?
Yeah. Well, there isn't consensus.
There isn't.
There was consensus. It happened at a moment because what TikTok did was they made a serious mistake. So they unleashed their 100 million plus users. And what they did on everybody's TikTok, they said, hey, put in your zip code. Okay, now here is the name of your congressman and their office phone number and their office email. Go complain to them that you... not to ban TikTok and that you love TikTok. So Congress was just overwhelmed with this. And so the House Committee on this in particular, it had exactly the opposite effect. Both sides are like, oh my God, this is what could happen if the Chinese Communist Party unleashed TikTok on our youth.
There might be like this really intense democracy going on.
So, but my understanding is in the Senate, there is no consensus. And that it's not clear that this will even be taken up, partly because it's an election year, but I think partly because you have, you know, more, what's the word Elon Musk, but a free speech originalist or really a principled free speech. There's like Rand Paul and there's people on the Democrat side also who have concerns about this. So
I understand that. And there should be.
Yeah. So I don't think there's an absolute consensus, but it's funny how, for a moment, there can be, you know.
But what did I miss? I made a, like, where was I when that happened? Because that part of the story I didn't get.
Oh, I was literally just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, you know, but it was probably when I was making my wedding at the end of February. No,
it was very interesting and a lot of debate about whether that was good or bad that TikTok did that. But in Congress, people commented and said, I was on the fence. Now I'm hard over. We got to ban these guys, you know.
Boy, I'm more contemptuous of them than I was even before I heard this accusation. Mike, believe it or not, we have exhausted the patience of just about everybody at this point, besides yourself and me. We obviously could discuss this all day long, but I'm so glad that we caught up.
Yeah.
And let's not wait another year. Things are moving fast, fast, fast.
Absolutely.
Let's check in again soon.
I'll put you on. I'm going back to Washington again in the spring. And then subsequent to that, there's always something interesting that I learn that happens. So, and I would expect this Murthy case that we started off our conversation on, probably that decision will be one of the last decisions and one of the most consequential decisions of this Supreme Court term. So it probably will be in June when that comes out, and who knows, you know, where that's going to go. But be very interesting at that time to have another conversation.
I predict an affirmance, a little bit of trimming, but I do think it will be affirmed.
Yeah.
Mike, great talking to you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Hey, thank you for listening to the Coleman Nation podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. If you like the show, please rate it 5 stars and leave a review. For more information, please visit the show's website at coleman-nation.com. That's coleman-nation.com. Or you can visit my blog at likelihoodofconfusion.com. Join us next time on the Coleman Nation podcast and have a great day.